Welcome to the Wisdom Circle. To subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast platforms, please visit us at www.thewisdomcircle.com.
Welcome to the Wisdom Circle. My friend Tony Ponturo, 46 years ago, bumped into each other in a cubicle in BBDO in 1978, have been doing, concluding our first year with the biggest guest we could hope to have, and just a wonderful guy who I've known for 20 years, and we are really excited to have Michael Kasson with us. Michael, welcome, and thank you for closing the circle of wisdom and the wisdom circles.
Oh my God, I didn't even know I could get into that wisdom circle, but I'm very happy to be here and spend some time with two folks that I consider friends for, you know, what feels like a life. Yeah, you know, it's a long road, and it's been nice to have both of you along the road. So nice to be here.
It's true. It's really true. When you get to this point and you're still, you know, feeling warmth and affection for people you worked with, where you've had to butt heads a little bit and you've had to kind of work your way through things, but it's always been, you know, respectful and I guess a total joy to be, you know, working with you and certainly with Tony. So it's a fun time in our lives.
I appreciate that, guys. And I do love to, you know, have conversations around things that can add to people's wisdom. And yes, knowing sitting with the two of you and having a conversation as free flow as we can make it, I think we'll find some nuggets along the way.
Time, trust me when I tell you, time will fly. I want to already not be the only one talking. So Tony, I'd like to turn it over to you just to give your thoughts on.
Michael, what I was going to say is beyond the wisdom, we should understand where your energy source is. Where do you plug in? I mean, you keep going, you keep impacting. We were talking before offline, you're heading off to New York for the upfront. In June, you go to Cannes. When you're making rain, I feel like, you know, we're little pipers over here.
Well, it's funny when you talk about the travel schedule, two things that have been consistent in my life for, you know, nearly 40 years. I never get to be in L.A. for Mother's Day because that's always the Sunday before the upfront. And Father's Day coincidentally falls on the Sunday before Cannes. So in close to 40 years, I've been home in L.A. for Mother's Day and Father's Day exactly twice. And that was during the pandemic. So, you know, there were some good things that came out of the pandemic, you know, to be honest. So I didn't have to make those treks during those periods. But yeah, the journey continues. And, you know, it's funny. I've always wondered when we'd reach that inflection point when upfront wasn't necessary. And obviously, you guys know better than I, but at least as well, supply and demand curve was what created the need for an upfront. But I guess you guys would also know that the reason the upfronts happen when they do and why, and this is good if we're talking about wisdom, it's history.
Yes.
Why the upfronts were always focused on a season that started in September. I'm going to bet you guys know why. Probably wouldn't. It was the auto industry, because that's when the auto industry, as we all remember, would introduce the new cars. And so when was the money going to be spent? They were going to put the money down in September so Dinah Shore could say, see the USA and your Chevrolet. I'm really dating myself here, guys. Yeah, but
we were all watching it.
Yeah, well, let's not brag about that. I'm glad.
Well, see, Michael, I always thought like the big networks wanted to get that 60% of the money all down before they went on vacation.
Yeah, well, same thing. But I think they planned their vacations based on that 60% of the money, Tony. But the truth is that was the history of it. And, you know, do we still need an upfront now? Probably not. But is it still a good time for people to get together? And, you know, we will discuss, I'm sure, some of my view around the importance of convening. It has a lot to do with my new venture. But the idea of convening and that moment when we can have canapes and, you know, some cheap wine and see all our friends for a few days in a row during the upfront, that has value. And I do understand the importance of that touching and feeling. You know, a bit of advice I got when I was a young player in this industry and a mentor for me, Dennis Holt, who brought me into the business, said back then we didn't have email. We did have fax. And Dennis used to say, if you have a choice of using your feet, your fax, or your phone, use your feet. Get in front of your client. Have that have that eye contact, be with the person. So the upfront does serve a purpose.
Yes.
In that context for people.
Not the one that it was intended for. I totally agree. Michael, interesting. And I don't want to do the whole show about the upfront because you've got so much to offer us. But have you noticed the difference between like the pre-pandemic upfront gathering and the post has, or is it just?
You know what, Ray? I thought I would, but I really didn't. Uh-huh. You know, when I think back to last year's upfront, which was post-pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, the showcases were big. The, you know, musical guests were great. You had, you know, the usual, you know, Jimmy Fallon at NBC and Jimmy Kimmel at ABC and, you know, the normal stuff we'd all expect and that we've all come to know.
Yeah.
Production values were there, but sure. Where's the focus? The focus was on sports and live more than on the new series that you did see happening, but that's reflective of the marketplace and how and where money is being spent. So, I mean, that's a good segue into, you know, where was the focus? It was on live events and sports more than it was on the new sitcom or the new, you know, procedural.
And more so next week. I know you're going to hear that. Tony and I, who are two simple guys from New York, just bumped. Oh, by the way, it's his Pope. He went to Villanova. So now he's bragging about the Pope.
And, you know, it is a special moment, and I'm a nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn, but having an American Pope actually means a lot.
Cool.
You know, Tony, I've always said the difference between Jews and Catholics, it's very simple. You know the difference, right? The guilt is the same.
Yes.
Guilt, Jewish guilt, it's the same. It's just you pay retail, we buy it wholesale.
That's right.
And we make dinner and you make reservations.
Exactly. And we do it really, really well.
Really well. New York City thanks you.
You know, I just wanted one quick anecdote, Michael, before we leave here, because I love what you said about doing things in person and looking eye to eye. And, you know, Ray gets a little tired of my Anheuser-Busch stories, but I'm going to make at least listen to one more. So one of my last deals was with Fox Sports, you know, Super Bowl, you know, the bowl game, championship, baseball, NASCAR, the whole bet. And Neil Mulcahy, who is a young head of sports sales, comes over. Jim Burnett's just retired. John Nesbitt's there. We give him a counter proposal to a five-year deal. And Neil, who's just now in charge of sports sales, gets up and starts walking out of the room. And I said, where are you going? And he goes, well, we're going to go back to my office and we'll think about it. And then we'll call you back. I said, no. I said, we have all the decision makers here. We spent the next 3 hours working it out and did a deal. And he said, in all my years, and he was still a relatively young guy then, I never did a deal face-to-face. It was always on the phone. And it just showed. I said, how much time do you think we saved? We just did that in 3 hours. It would have been 3 months. Anyway, the face-to-face.
You know, it's such an interesting, I'm going to take that someplace that you wouldn't expect me to take it. Because it's a dynamic in the business that's happening right now. This emergence of what everybody calls retail media networks, I'm getting granular here, guys. I hope that's okay.
But
because it's really in line with what you were just talking about. I will call it what we have started to use in the marketplace is to brand them all as commerce networks. Because it's really commerce. It's around digital commerce. So retail media doesn't seem to fit anymore because if it was just Walmart and Target doing it, that's retail or Albertsons or Kroger. But now you have Lyft and Uber and PayPal and they're not retailers. They're creating commerce media networks. So I kind of adopted that name.
Very cool.
But I had a conversation with somebody who shared the fact, but let me switch to Cannes for a moment because this is where it manifested itself.
All wisdom.
The idea was, somebody said last year, this is the first time that fully a third of the chief marketing officers that hit the ground in Cannes were also media sellers. And I found that to be interesting because they're now in the business of selling media at places like Uber and Lyft and Chase Bank and Home Depot. And so the CMO also has to be wearing the hat of helping drive the retail media or commerce media sales. And one of the CMOs said to me, it's different because I'm selling, you know, I'm like selling now. And I looked at the person and I said, you know, I've got to call you on that. I call me crazy, but I think the job of a CMO is to sell stuff. Part of the job is certainly to sell stuff.
Yep.
But what you're not used to is selling mano a mano. You're used to selling one to many. Now you're called into a sales meeting to get somebody to take money out of their pocket, their media budget, and spend it on your property mano a mano. That's the difference. So the face-to-face matters. And I know that's not exactly analogous to what you were saying, Tony, but it conjured it up for me because we're talking about dynamics in the industry and how things are changing. Absolutely. I'll tell you one further story about that. And it's really appropriate to this moment. I was speaking to a CMO this morning, this is very timely, who was planning on going to Cannes. And because they're in retail, they said, we're afraid, everything's booked. I've got my hotel, I've got my ticket, probably even non-refundable at this point, but I'm nervous about the look. Does it look right when we're going through this massive economic upheaval with tariffs and this and that, and I'm a retailer? Does it look right for me to be in Cannes? And I said, well, let me ask you a question. What if it was called the Cleveland Lions? Would it be a problem? They said, no, that's the problem. Cannes, it sounds. I go, yeah, but let me just tell you, that's just the location. The work we're doing there is real work. So yeah, could we have picked a location that would have a better sensibility? Mm-hmm. Okay. But I said to this person, here's the way I would make the case to your CEO, because that's what this person now needs to do. Because of optics.
Yeah, of course.
I said, remind your CEO that you're not just there as a chief marketing officer who's looking for new inspiration for your next campaign. You're a seller selling retail media as well.
Mm-hmm.
So tell your CEO that you're not there for a party to just look at the work and have some rosé. You're actually going to be in sales meetings driving revenue.
Yes.
On the ground. It's just how the world is changing, guys. And again, I'm riffing here. So
absolutely. I'll tell you that I put my career on the line with a story Abe Madcourt wrote about my time in the business when I said, and the headline was, I don't care what anyone says, everyone is selling. Brian Roberts is selling to shareholders. Steve Burke is selling to Brian Roberts. Ray Warren is selling to Steve Burke. It is a never-ending cycle.
I've always said the receptionist to the CEO is a salesperson.
Exactly. But I want to take a moment for Tony and I to hurt ourselves once again for patting ourselves on the back for somehow figuring out we're going to be in the sports business for a very long time.
You know, Ray, I used to be able to do that, but as I get older, my shoulder, it doesn't...
that did hurt, actually.
The problem.
But we somehow fell into the sports business, not because we had the vision that knowing in 2025 it would be 40% of the upfront, but because we're like, it's fun, it's live, it's relevant, it's not a soap opera, it's not like, you know, prime time, who cares? And I'm just so delighted about how strong.
No, it's everywhere you look. I said to somebody the other day, I was reminiscing about that famous scene in the movie The Graduate when the friend of the dad comes up to, turned out to be Mrs. Robinson's husband, but comes up to Benjamin Braddock and says, I have one word for you, plastics. And somebody asked me about, What's the state of play in media today? I look at them and I say, I have one word for you, sports.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And it's so big. I was going through a sports business journal of all the, I don't know, there's like 400 people that used to be 20 people, like in terms of influential business.
And especially, you know, the rise in women's sports and what's happening and the importance of aligning, you know, not from a DE&I perspective, just from, hey, this is good stuff. This is good. This is competitive.
Care.
I'm sorry, Ray. That Josh Harris, who owns the Commanders along with his conglomerate group, just raised $112 million, which isn't a lot for him, but for youth sports, you know. And so, you know, I'm working on some project where youth sort of hockey maybe.
One of the first sponsorships I ever worked on was Soapbox Derby, guys. So,
bring it.
I did that with a guy who became rather famous and had a go-kart idea. You might know him as Zach Brown, who runs McLaren. So Zach told a story recently that his first pitch ever was to me. And so the audience, we did something together in Cannes a couple of years ago where he brought Lando and Zach, and I interviewed him, and I said, first of all, Lando, I don't like you because you're so good looking and you're so rich and you're so, you know, and so good at what you do. And then Zach said, you know, something about his career journey, and he said, looked out at the audience, and he said, I'd like many of you to say your first pitch was to Michael Kasson And so the audience said, "How'd you do?" He said, "He didn't buy it." I said, "Yeah." I said, "But obviously, Zach, it worked out for you."
I didn't realize, staying on the topic, that I just saw a piece on Zach Brown, or I guess on McLaren, that he was was a marketer. He had raced, but he was really a marketer. I did not realize that.
I met Zach because his mother — this is really inside baseball — but Zach's mother was one of the leading travel agents in the entertainment business. Lisa Brown, and that's how I met, and she was my travel agent back in the day, and I met Zach as a young kid, and he came to pitch me on something when I was running, you know, Western Media.
Wow. So, Michael, how and Meg and I have hit this topic 1,000 times with young people that have come on the Wisdom Circle. How are young people — some of them are, you know, they're bringing people back to the office, but it's still, you know, a work in progress, I guess. So how are — when you're talking to clients and et cetera, how are the young people buying into this understanding that you have to do a little face-to-face?
Yeah, it's challenging, but they get it. What I said — I stole this from John Wren. John Wren said something very intelligent at the beginning of the pandemic when he was addressing what Omnicom's, you know, office policy was going to be. And I gave John credit for it then, and I will continue to. He said they were going to have an office-centric culture at Omnicom. I think he's probably moved a little from that, but it was office centric. And I like what that said, because it's not — we're going to a whole different setup. We're still going to be focused on the office should be the center of where you come to go where you show up for work.
Right.
And that's the mentality. And I agree with it, because the water cooler does matter.
Yeah.
Yes.
The problem today is the water cooler is still relevant, and it is relevant, especially for young people, because that's how you learn.
And grow and meet people you might otherwise meet.
You know, but the problem in the water cooler is when you walk by everyone's office, what are they doing? They're sitting in their computer on a Zoom.
Yes.
So, you know, the idea doesn't resonate as well with younger people, because they — what's the difference?
Right.
Like, I'm sitting in my office on a Zoom. I could be sitting at my home on a Zoom, and I lose the commute time. I mean, you can get both sides of that trade, but I lean into the office-centric mentality because it's important.
Yeah.
And you know, I created a job years ago, and I'm sure you guys dealt with one of these people over the last 16 years. I created a role called Chief of Stuff, and it was, you know, a unique title, and I didn't think I was cool enough to have a Chief of Staff, because I thought, like, you know, the president has a Chief of Staff, and it was self-aggrandizing to me. But I said, the role you're in — for these young people that I brought into this role, and I have eight of them now, there's the eighth person in this role, just joined 2 weeks ago, actually — I said, you're going to learn by watching. I don't think in a linear fashion, so I don't think I'd ever be a good teacher, because I think you have to write a linear lesson plan to be a teacher. I said, but I'm somebody you can learn by watching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the in-person — back to what you were saying, Tony — the in-person matters.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to actually feel it, see it, touch it.
Well, what's funny is that Tony and I have been talking about it for a year, probably, on the Wisdom Circle. And I love this all, because really everything we're saying is relevant to Z's, X's, millennials, maybe not alphas, but it's really good stuff. And I think a year ago, it seemed kind of old school. Oh, yeah, you know, these guys want people to go in the office. And a year later, there's a lot more young people realizing who we have.
They lost out on something.
It's not important.
You lose out on something. It's both ways. It's not just one. Yes. It's not just what's in it for me. Mm-hmm. It's what's in it for you.
Yep.
You know, I like to see people showing up, mm-hmm, because you feel that camaraderie, and you feel that, you know, exchange of ideas again. But you have to make sure you just don't take your computer from this desk to put it at another desk and don't interact with the people, because then you haven't achieved anything.
Right. Yeah, but also to listen to people that have been around. I taught leadership and crisis management at NYU after my Anheuser-Busch days. I used to show a picture of Yogi Berra when he was like 85 years old, and he looked like Yoda, right? And he'd be on the — they'd be in the dugout with Derek Jeter during spring training. And I would go to the young people and say, why do you think Derek Jeter's talking to this old man, right? And that's how they looked at it. And then I would pull up a picture of Yogi when he was 28 years old and all his statistics and say, okay, he was, you know, he was there, he did it, and Derek smart enough to understand. Tell me how you hit a curveball. You know, how did you play the game? You know, and so they were smart enough to do it. So
well, but what they didn't know, and I think we lost Tony's picture here, guys. But
I think his Italian might have hit the camera button. I just doing the
hand,
thing.
It just so hand gestures are screwing everything up.
What you didn't know, guys, and you gave me time, Tony, by going off camera, you gave me time to get a prop. So can I show you a prop? Because had Derek Jeter known, he could have called me, because this was my Dodger adult fantasy camp picture in 1990, buddy.
So wow. There you go. There you go.
Very nice.
You know, you're telling baseball stories to a baseball player. Come on.
Oh, geez. All right. So I have to ask, what position did you play?
I played second base, and when I went to adult fantasy camp in 1990, it was a Hall of Fame camp, so it wasn't just Dodgers, but it was at Vero Beach, but it was all Hall of Fame players. So in my camp was Frank Robinson and Harmon Killebrew and Willie Stargell and Duke Snyder and Bob Feller and Lou Brock. I mean, I could go on and on and
good
on.
Lord.
We won the intramurals, my team, and so we got to play against the pros in Holman Field in the stadium. In Vero Beach. And I called my wife and I said, honey, you never got to see me play baseball in high school. Here's the chance. I'm going to get up and I'm going to have to pit. I'm going to have to get up against a major league pitcher. So this is a first one. This is a one and done for me. You got to be there. And of course, I drew the short straw. And again, many of our listeners and viewers might not know this name, but I think you guys will. The pitcher that I grew was Hoyt Wilhelm. And he was famous
for
his knuckleball. And he threw the first pitch, and I'm up there, and he threw the first pitch, and he threw a knuckleball. And I swung at the pitch on Monday. It arrived at home plate on Thursday. I was so far out in front of that ball. And the next pitch, he threw a fastball, and I got a hit. So at least, not a big hit, but it was over the third base bag. I got on base, and I said, I did it. It was a drop the bat moment, you know.
Wow.
Anyway.
I'll tell you my one baseball story. The Cubs blew us out when I was at OND to play at Wrigley Field on a day the Cubs have this very long road trip in the middle of the summer. So we're at Wrigley Field. And I'm warming up on the sideline. And Rick Russell comes over and says, so let me see you throw a high hard one. And I throw the ball as high and hard. I tore my rotator cuff.
If you weren't on video, I could tell you the best
Bill kind of hurts.
Story ever. You guys remind me to tell you a Lou Brock story, because if I told it on the air, we'd be canceled.
Okay, well, the good news is Tony and I are both the executive producers, the network presidents, but we'll keep it clean. John, yeah. You have a baseball story? You must have played a ton of stuff as the Budweiser guy.
Well, what I do have is a great Lou Brock story. So this is like 7 degrees of separation. So when McGuire's going after Babe Ruth's record, right? Or Roger Maris's record, actually, because Maris broke Babe Ruth. Right. And Major League Baseball comes to St. Louis, Busch Stadium. They have a little manufactured box, you know, to extend off the stadium on the field. And the Maris family's there. And I get invited by baseball along with Lou Brock. Lou Brock happened to be there. Well, there was a guy from the Hall of Fame with this velvet case. I better not use my hands.
Keep your hands down.
And he took out Roger Maris's bat that he hit 61.
Oh, my God.
So Lou's got it. So I go to Lou, you know, and I could see the Hall of Fame guy's eyes go, don't give him the bat. I said, Lou, I knew Lou because he lived in St. Louis. I said, Lou, I got to touch the bat. So I touched the bat, you know. 30 minutes later, McGuire hits the home run and then jumps into the box with the Maris family. And David Hill, who was the head of sports production, is like zooming in. And my big fat face is there, you know. But the real story is I got to touch Maris's bat because Lou Brock happened to be sitting
there. Well, I was watching it.
That's a good one. I had a guy who worked for me, Eric Fernandez, years ago, who had done the deal for AT&T to do the stadium in San Francisco, because he had been, you knew Eric, I presume, did sports and sponsorships for AT&T.
Sure.
For years. And he came to work for me. And he calls me one day when the All-Star game was in New York. He goes, Michael, what are you doing at 6 o'clock on Tuesday? I said, I guess I'm about to find out. He says, meet me at the Carlisle Hotel. This was my moment. He says, meet me at the Carlisle Hotel. I said, okay, is there something you want to tell me more? He says, no, just meet me there. It'll be worth your while. I get there, meet him in the lobby. We go upstairs. He invited me to spend an hour with Willie Mays in his suite.
And, oh, wow.
There you go.
That's didn't get better than that. Although I did have to tell him I was a Dodger fan. I did have to tell him a Dodger fan, you know, so it was a moment. But, you know, you think of those highlights in your life and we're
and
back
that's
to sports.
This is.
Here we are. By the way, we're talking about sports. So there you go, guys.
And here's how Ray brings it back to Wisdom Circle, which is this is about showing up. This is about sticking around. This is about building a career and a brand name in the business that will support some highs and lows and fun and not so much fun.
It's all a journey, guys. You know, we start here and there's a continuum from, you know, from hither to yon. So it's a journey.
Tell us a little bit. Tell us, I want to hear a little bit about the Michael Kassinger. So you get out of college. And
yeah,
then
I was born in Brooklyn, grew up in L.A. Yes. We came across the plains in Conestoga wagons in the early.
You lived with the Dodgers. You can say
yeah,
that.
Exactly. You know, one more story about that family. You know, the area where Dodger Stadium is called Chavez Ravine, and there was the story of the very loyal Dodger family that followed the Dodgers, and when they moved to L.A., their family moved, and they had their first kid, and they named him Chavez Levine. It's a it's an inside. It's Borscht Belt humor, guys.
But I'm bummed.
But you know, we moved to California in the early 50s. But I had a special gift. The concept of being bicoastal was something that didn't exist in the 50s because it wasn't that easy. But we actually were because my grandparents and close aunts and uncles were still in New York, so I'd go back to New York for the summers. It wasn't bicoastal where I was going back and forth every week.
Right.
But my summers in New York and do the New York things that you did, which in the 50s, there was a real marked difference between the East Coast and the West Coast. New York was New York. L.A. was still a bit of a hick town making its way from a culture standpoint and from other things. So having that sensibility and having that, thank you, Billy Joel, New York state of mind in L.A. when I was a kid. Excuse me, was a real advantage, I think, because I had that New York state of mind. And
yeah,
still is.
You grow up faster. And I had that experience, even though I grew up in L.A.
Yeah.
Because of the summers. So that was the journey then. I obviously was here, went to school here, went to college, went to law school, then made a decision I had a mentor in my life, happened to be a cousin of mine, Stanley Gold, who was famous for his being part of the Walt Disney, he brought Michael Eisner in and sent Michael Eisner home and created along with Roy Disney and was a mentor to me. And Stanley had gone to law school as I did, and then he went and got a master's. And so I had the idea of getting a master's. He had done his in labor law. I decided to do mine in tax. So Ronnie and I got married when I was in law school 50 years ago. We just celebrated our 50th anniversary last December. Thank you. And we moved back to New York and I went to graduate school at NYU to get my master's in tax. And so my first 10 years of my career, guys, I was a tax lawyer.
Wow.
And, you know, primarily because I was in L.A., worked with folks in the entertainment industry, because in those days, the Beltway in L.A., the high net worth individuals who would need tax work, there wasn't a Silicon Alley or, you know, a Silicon Beach or a Silicon Valley. There was mostly in LA, it was the entertainment industry and it would be real estate. I mean, you know, those were the areas that I would get clients referred to me because I was doing tax law. And along the way, I represented some folks in the media buying business as well. And one of those people happened to be Dennis Holt. And Dennis Holt was the founder, as you guys will remember, of what was the first and largest media agency in the world. And I was Dennis's lawyer. And at one point in time, Dennis turned to me. And there were things on the journey along the way, which I'll throw in, but giving you the journey to media.
Yeah.
Dennis asked me to come in the early 90s to be the chief operating officer of what was then the largest media agency in the world, Western International Media. Mm-hmm. And I say that because I guess my training course was a little different than most. I didn't know the difference between a GRP and a TRP. And I was on my first day on the job. the COO of the largest media agency in the world. I won't say that again, but to make the
point. That's a big start.
I had to learn the job on the job.
At 100 miles.
And there was a scene from one of my favorite Eddie Murphy movies, which is 48 Hours, when Eddie Murphy gets deputized by Nick Nolte. And he walks up to the bar and he's wearing a cowboy hat. And he says, "My name's Reggie Hammond and I'm the new sheriff in town." That was kind of my moment. My name's Michael Kasson and I'm the new sheriff in town. Yeah. Except I didn't know how to shoot a gun. I didn't know how to be a sheriff. I had to learn. So what I did is I went around to every one of the department heads at Western Media who ran national broadcast and local broadcast and yellow pages. Imagine that. And out of home and magazine and all the different things that we did. We didn't have internet. We didn't have any of that, but it was, you know, the basic, you know, the basic things that we all started with. And I walked around to each one of those department leads who had fiefdoms. These people had built a very big company and there were thousands of employees. And I went to each one of the department's heads and I said, "Look, you know, and I know that as chief operating officer, I don't know much. So I need you to help me. In these next 6 months, I'd like each one of you to give me an executive training program. Because I have to learn what you do, not well enough to do it, but well enough to be a good partner to you. Because if you don't think that I know what you do and understand what you're doing, then any advice or direction or counsel I'm going to give you is going to be meaningless to you because you'll think I don't have the context for it. But if you educate me enough to understand, and I'll mention a name that I know you both will remember, Billy Crosdale. I sat down with Crosdale, who was the dean of national broadcast in those days. I think you'd agree, at least
pretty
at
much.
the top of the heap.
I worked for him for about a year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, and we shared something in common. Bill and I had the same birthday. He was just 30 years older than me, but we had the same birthday. but literally, December 11th was Billy's birthday and mine. Funny. And I said to him, "Bill, you have to teach me. I can't be helpful to you until you tell me." And he tutored me and he took me to my first upfront. And he said, "This is what and how and where." And so I was fortunate to have those people. And then 6 months later, when I gave those people, all the department heads, my opinion, and I took on the leadership role that I was given, they listened to me differently. So I think that was the lesson that I could share here. Don't go in and think you're a know-it-all if you don't know what the hell you're talking about.
And we've had a couple of guys, Tony, I know you have the open door story, but we have a couple of folks who've come on and they've been dropped in, parachuted in, or brought in with the staff. And that is really meaningful advice to just know what you don't know and be willing to say it out loud.
And embrace the... embrace the partnership. If I'm your boss, I don't look at it that way. I look at it as I'm your associate. I'm your partner. I'm your, I want to.
That sounds much more like when we talk, and you and I, Mike, when we talked offline, that is so, I'm not here to just tell you how great you are, I think you are. That was so far ahead of its time to behave that way. Because we lived in climb the corporate ladder world, kill your next door neighbor, get promoted. The current generation thinks like that, but at a much different level. And I just think you're bringing it to a company at a high level is something everyone should hear and listen to, that it doesn't start, it starts at the top.
Ray, you said something really interesting there because you and I talked about this, I think, but I've said this, told this story a million times. I think I'm a really collaborative competitor. I'm extraordinarily competitive and I never like to come in second. So let's be clear. I'm motivated. I'm competitive. I have a real competitive streak. Maybe it comes from sports, but it just comes from my DNA. But but I'm a collaborative competitor. I compete.
Yeah.
I don't ever denigrate my competitor. That's not my style. Others have different styles. I embrace my competitor because I look at it as, hey, you won this one. I'm going to get you the next time. I don't write them off. Maybe it comes from practicing law, although I never did litigation, but because I was a tax lawyer. But, you see it all the time where two lawyers fighting each other on behalf of their clients. You see them having dinner the next day and you're going, wait, I thought you hated each other. No, we're doing our job there. This is our life. That's different in this case, but it's not. When you know, we did more media reviews than anybody in the world over the last 20 years, and somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. When I decided to start doing media reviews, to be perfectly clear, one of the things that was made me hesitate was, well, gee, for me, the only good news is if there's four competitors, I can lose three friends. Or not lose three friends, but I can piss off three friends.
You gotta give bad news to three people.
I can piss off three friends by giving them bad news. And, you know, I don't mind sharing this even publicly. I had a conversation with a CEO of a holding company, and I'm proud of what I'm about to say because it's a good story. So I don't mind sharing it. I had a call from somebody with a British accent once saying, well, I don't understand why we don't win every pitch you lead because Erwin Gottlieb's your best friend. I said, well, you're correct. Erwin's one of my best friends in the world. He's like a brother to me, but that doesn't mean he wins everything we do. I said, that's not the deal here. Let me give you baseball. I said, you know, this British fellow might not have understood the concept of tie goes to the runner. I said, look, I'm an honest guy. Maybe if it's tie goes to the runner, Erwin might be the runner. I'm honest enough to say that, but not guaranteeing that.
No advantage. So it's funny because I was just thinking what you were saying. I want to throw it to Tony because I think what made Tony such a great client was he was a collaborative competitor. So he'd come in with Anheuser-Busch money, and I was at ABC, so we were counting the house, right? We knew exactly what was going to happen and how we had to price it and what we had to move. And you'd get the big Erwin Gottlieb-type shops and the other big shops. And
well, Erwin would send in the enforcer. He'd send Reno in. Come on, let's
talk. Well, I was going to say Reno. I started with Reno at Ted Bates.
He would have sent Reno in with his black turtleneck and his, you know.
I'm on the phone with Reno during one up front. He's like, it's plus 3%. We have all the clients. We know it's plus three. I'm like, well, I just sold plus seven and I'm out of Tuesday night. So if you want to keep talking, we can. But by the time you're done, it'll be nine plus nine and you won't have anything to buy other than movies. Tony would come in and collaborative competitor was so important because he always got the best deal. And I think at some point I had to show you the actual numbers, Tony, to convince you. But because it was collaborative, you wanted to take care of him. You never, like Reno, God bless him, dear friend since 76. I go back 2 years more. But like once he was done, he took every drop off the table. Yeah. Tony left a little bit of, like, you know, guns and, you know, sidearms and mules. And you could get home and fight the Indians if you had
but,
to.
You know,
so
Ray,
took care of him because of that.
That's a wonderful story, but it's so important because relationships matter. And, you know, I hear this all the time. Gee, Michael, you know, you're great at relationships or this or that, or in our business. And the way I describe my business, I think, you know, is worthy of my saying it out loud here, is, you know, at the intersection of marketing, media, advertising, entertainment, sports, and technology. So in my business, in the intersection that I live in, and I think it's similar to the intersection you guys live in, the idea is understanding all the various constituents around that table and what their needs are, but understanding it from the standpoint of, I don't have to get the last dollar off of this deal. I have to be able to live to fight another day, and understanding how all those things come together, because what's good for that person might not be good for this person. But I always tell this to people in relationship advice. Relationships are never 50-50, because 50-50 is a standoff. Relationships are 80-20 on one day in my favor and 70-30 the next day in your favor. And that's what long-term relationships do. You'll get me now. I'm going to get you next time.
True. That's interesting.
To your point, Michael, you know, I always tell this story because you never know where you're going to get the value that goes beyond the efficiency or the CPM. It was the 06 World Series, and it was in St. Louis. It was the Cardinals in Detroit. And the tradition of Anheuser-Busch was the Clydesdales would go around the track of the baseball field before the game and pregame. I had forgotten to align this with with Fox and with Major League Baseball. To then learn that Fox had already nailed down the set for the pregame with the cables all along the dirt path, in which I now had to get on my knees and call Tim Bryson, who was, you know, number three at Major League Baseball, and Fox, and say, guys, I need your help. I can't go back to our CEO and say the Clydesdales aren't going around. meet us there at 11 o'clock. They were at like a, you know, how the networks and the leagues would have these, you know, game three, you know, parties for the advertisers. Meet them down there and figure out how to pick the wire up, put some sort of stanchion up so the Clydesdales could go under like it was a bridge. If you had been a pain in the ass, pardon the expression, negotiator and got every penny, they would say, "Sorry, Tony, go tell your CEO it's not going to happen."
No, but that's not.
And that's where you got to understand it. The other thing, and then I'll shut up, is I think it's so important. You know, Adam Silver, as you know, was a lawyer first. And then, of course, David Stern, who was a lawyer, you know, brought him into the NBA.
Yeah, moment for David Stern, please.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's a good man.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if people ask me.
I love Adam, but David was, I was fortunate to know David pretty well and just enjoyed so much time with him that when I hear his name, I take a moment.
No, I agree. People say, who was your most admired person in the business? I always say, it starts with David Stern. No question. But the point I'm circling is my pet peeve about executive recruiters, and I don't know how you feel about this, is some of them have to check off what I'll call the obvious, you know, boxes to say, okay, you could be president of a sports team, but did you work in a ticket office? Did you do this and do this? And what they're really missing is you want the right brains, the right, you know, human traits, someone that maybe looks at things differently, like you have as a trained lawyer, and that you've missed so many opportunities by saying, well, you never worked in a ticket office for a team, so you can't.
Exactly. And you know, I'm going to give you, when you said about, you know, interviewing somebody or headhunting, we were at a dinner party at some friend's home in the Hamptons a couple of years ago, and this guy is famous for his dinner parties, and he's a raconteur, and he's a wonderful host, and everybody kind of thrive, you know, you desire to be invited to one of his dinner parties because you know it's going to be an interesting group of people and you know it's going to be an interesting conversation. It's kind of like, you know, a parlor. It's like a Gertrude Stein. I mean, you know, and he did something at a dinner party a few years ago where he said, okay, the thought starter at this dinner party is I want everybody to look at their phone and tell us your Uber rating. And that was so interesting because everybody's, oh, well, mine's a 4-point whatever, but you know, it's because my kids use it, or, oh, mine's, you know, and you watch. So the reason I tell you that story, first of all, it's a great dinner party thing. Like it starts you off on a great note, use it. But I now ask that in every job interview I do. Anybody I'm hiring, I say, do me a favor, tell me what your Uber rating is.
Wow, that's really
it's a
smart.
Good question. It's a good it question. It tells you how people interact.
Yeah, exactly.
When they have a position of power.
It's an element. It may not be definitive, absolutely. But it's an element. I found it so interesting because what you were saying, Tony, and it is about the ability to interact with people. That's a critical thing. Look, when Dan Snyder bought the Redskins, and, you know, not called the Redskins now, but when he bought them,
right.
He called me. It was 1999. I got a phone call, right hand of God, from Dan Snyder saying, Michael, and I was running Western Media. He said, Michael, you want to be president of the Redskins? I said, Dan, I'm not a football fan. I played baseball and I love basketball. I mean, football's great, but that's not. He goes, it's okay. It's a marketing job. That's the reason I tell you that story.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
You don't have to throw a pass to do that job.
No,
because this is really, I look at this as a marketing job. I'm not asking you to be the GM, although he might have been better off with me than him, but the way it worked out, but Dan's a friend, but you know,
well, you're talking to a guy who was asked to go run a place called Telemundo Sports and like, you know, yo quiero tequila, pero no más. So I was like, okay, there's my Spanish.
Yo estudio español en la escuela por 5 años, pero muchos años pasado.
And I got 3 hands behind me that show how we did at Telemundo. To your point, you know, it's about leadership. It's about honesty. It's about truth. It's about vision. It's not just about.
But look, you asked me to give you a journey. So my journey's been a little different than others. In the middle of that, I ended up being a chicken king, you know, or a prince at least. I operated dozens and dozens of fast food restaurants, never as my full-time business, but as a side hustle. I was the lawyer for a company called El Pollo Loco when they started in the United States. And I,
Were you on Breaking Bad?
No, but it's funny, Ray. That's a funny story because Charlie Collier, someone we all know, Charlie was having breakfast one morning with Zach, Vince Galligan, the guy who created Breaking Bad. And Charlie was doing a Jeffrey Katzenberg. He was having two breakfasts. So I was his first one and Galligan was his second. So we finish and now he walks over to sit down with Vince and he introduces me. And I said, look, it's a pleasure to meet you, but I have a bone to pick with you. He said, what's that? I said, well, you had Pollos Hermanos and you had, you know, instead of making marinade in the back, they were making crystal meth. I had El Pollo Loco and we actually made marinade in the back. And unlike Gus, who didn't make it through the whole series, I'm still standing. So I actually have engaged on a competitive conversation about Pollos Hermanos and Pollo Loco.
What could I possibly say that you would say, you know what, I don't really know. I've never experienced that. You're just, your journey is so wide and deep. It's just, well, I want to give us a 5-minute warning.
Good for you. You have a clock.
I've been having too much fun just chatting, which was, I was afraid would be the problem here.
No, that's the point of the wisdom circle, right? I mean, we're not X's and O's necessarily. We can be, but we also can bring someone like you on and just listen to. And if you're not pulling anything out of it, then, you know, sorry, not sorry.
So I hope so. You know, a little bit of humor and a lot of stories. But, the journey has been interesting for me. And, you know, when I transitioned, I guess I could say it giving a career story and not bragging, but actually humbly sharing that in 2019, I got inducted into the Advertising Hall of Fame. And it was a big thing. And it was a really big thing for me.
Yeah,
sure, it's for everybody, but I took it seriously as I know everybody does, so I shouldn't say that. But I told a story, and it does tie back to sports. I said, I've always had a view of life in business that it's very much like baseball, and it has to do with batting averages. And the point I made was, in the history of Major League Baseball, there were 27 players who enjoyed a lifetime batting average of .333 or better. And I'm not that good at math, but I understand that means that you get a hit one out of three times when you get up to bat.
Right.
There's only one guy in the history that I know is Ted Williams, who hit .406 in 1941.
Yes,
so
he did.
33 as a lifetime batting average is not easy to achieve.
No.
And 27 players who did it, guess what? They are all in the Hall of Fame. So when I stood up to accept the award for being inducted into the Hall of Fame, I said, I guess the analogy was right. Because I've had three careers. I had the career as a lawyer, had a career as somebody running a media agency, and then I had a career in strategy and consulting business. I said, I guess I got to hit one out of three times because I'm in the Hall of Fame.
Well, so it's been two minutes.
Yeah, it plays well, but I was corrected by Mike Barnicle that night because that same year, Ann Finucane, the former vice chairman and chief marketing officer of Bank of America forever, was inducted into the Hall of Fame as well. And Mike, her husband, is a famous, you know, on air, but also was a sports writer. And I'm sure you guys know Mike Barnicle, awesome. And you know, wonderful man to boot. He came up to me and after my speech and he said, Michael, your speech was brilliant and, you know, wonderful. He said, but I do have to correct you. I said, what, Mike? I'm pretty sure I'm right on my statistic. He goes, well, you're close to right. I said, what did I get wrong? He said there were actually 28 players in history who achieved a lifetime batting. And it's not going to be who you think, because I know you're going to, most people say, oh, Pete Rose. No, he had the most hits. He didn't have a lifetime batting average of .333. Yeah. It was Wee Willie Keeler, the Black Sox, 1919.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So I got it almost right.
Yeah.
And, you know,
the only stat I have is from a guy who played basketball for North Carolina State. And he said, yeah, I was actually the highest percentage free throw shooter in the history of North Carolina State. I'm like, really? What was it? He goes, it was 1,000. I'm like, really? He goes, yeah, it was 2 for 2. Well, we could do this like for the rest of the day, but I know you have a day job. Tony and I.
I actually do, guys. You know, I'm building a new business, so I got a day job. I'm back in the hunt.
I wanted to do more about 3C Ventures, but I think we did a lot about sharing wisdom and getting to know Michael Kasson. 3CVentures.com is out there. and your podcast.
I'm having fun again, guys, and on the hunt. And thankfully, the wildlife is out there, and we're able to capture a fair amount of it. So I feel good about that. And what I feel good about is being able to spend an hour with two gentlemen that I've had great respect and affection for, you know, the arc of a career that we've all had. So this is special for me.
Thank you, Michael. Same here.
And thanks so much for joining us. And, you know, we look forward to seeing you more down the road, as they say.
As you will.
All right, good.
Thank you, guys.